Dinky Dawson, and Tony Rain, and we're kicking off our podcast, Two Pints in a Corner.
Welcome to Two Pints. Welcome, Mr. Jim Sullivan, if you have any. To Two Pints.
Hey there. All right, well, I will start here. One of my best memories of the channel, and it's a long-term memory, and in fact, it's the first chapter in my book, Backstage and Beyond, 45 years of classic rock chats and rants, is Jerry Lee Lewis. And I had seen him, in New Hampshire at the Club Casino, but more often at the channel. We struck up an odd friendship of sorts over the 5 or 6 years he played there. Saw him every time, had a backstage chat with him every time, sometimes drunk, sometimes sober, sometimes combative, sometimes huggy, profane, asking questions about whether we would go to heaven or hell. He'd go back and forth on that. I hope I'm going to heaven. I don't, you know. That's all in the book. And, I mean, my memories of that came back while I was writing the book. And, of course, I had a lot of text in the computer and at the Globe Archives, too. But that, to me, I mean, personally, was one of the highlights because, I mean, there was, one, the show where we was mixing, you know, country and rock. And, you know, just kicking ass. I mean, not acting like an old man at all.
Yeah.
And I felt just so happy to be in the midst of this, you know, wonderful, joyous music from the 50s that still lived. You know, here we were in the 80s. And then to go backstage and to have this relationship with him where he, you know, somehow established a trust with me. And I wrote a lot about that, both good and bad. But that was, seeing him was something that was very special to me. Another in the same sort of realm, I guess, is obviously Roy Orbison. Last ever show. And he and I had done an interview prior to that. He was in Paris. It was a phone interview. It was the last interview he did of any substance. And we had met before and we had talked before. Good rapport we had, and then I was talking about the upcoming channel show, and I knew he had this new record coming out. I had an advanced tape. It was a great record. It was coming out in 2 months. And he said, "You're going to be playing any songs from it at the club?" And he said, "Well, no, Jim. I just can't really do that to my fans because they don't know the songs yet, and that would be unfair to throw new material out them that they don't know." And he said, "But next time around, I'm hoping to work 3 or 4 of them in a set." And we all know what happened.
Yep.
And that never happened. The show itself, lives on again in my memory. And again, one of the chapters in the book, just this, this man, stoic man, standing pretty rigid at the stage, this tiny mouth, emitting these operatic rock vocals, ballads, and rockers. That were just so outstanding to be in the presence of and to be moved by. All the emotion, the sadness mostly, I guess, and the loneliness and just that, the pathos of it all. And, I knew it was special when I heard it because it was just such a moving show.
Then,
of course, in the aftermath, realizing that this was it. It ratcheted up in terms of importance in my life.
That's great. It's interesting as we've been talking to people that what the club meant to different people from different audiences as well, and that's what we are both been in agreement on all the time about the diversity to us being in there. You know, I wasn't in there for years, but being in there on a full time basis for a couple of years and seeing the changes and seeing some of those special people. I mean, I remember Eddie Kendricks and Ruffin in there. Charlie Watts Orchestra.
Yep.
You know, some real, like Chick Corea, some real legendary stuff.
James Brown.
John Entwistle,
things that you wouldn't expect in there. Yeah.
John Entwistle was funny. That was one of the ones where I went to talk to him after the show, and we were sort of, I guess, out of the dressing room between the stage. I guess people were clearing out, but we were talking, and I was asking him questions, and the answer to every question, the first answer was, "What?" And then I would repeat the question, and then he pretty much get it and answer the question. you know, his own bass playing, Townsend, Keith Moon, had pretty much ruined his ears.
Yeah.
Remember from the show that the show was one of the loudest shows I'd heard.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it, at the time, man, he has made a sacrifice for this music, but, you know, the one you make. And, I mean, I suffer some hearing loss now. I'm sure you guys probably do to a certain extent, too.
It was
kind of funny, but it was great. You know, it was a great show, him kind of not slumming it exactly, but, he's earning money for his alimony, basically, right?
He worked on. I remember doing them early in my time at the Melody Tent on the Cape with a thing called A Walk Down Abbey Road. And he was on the road it was like a Beatles show in the second half. And the first half, he did his solo stuff. But he was.
I didn't even know about that.
I remember him holding court backstage at 2 p.m. with a bottle of cognac and telling more stories.
That would be John. No, that was great. One of the things you were talking about, which I very much agree with, is the diversity in the club's bookings. Yeah. I mean, you can look at almost any random week from that era and see, I think as you were talking about earlier, I mean, hardcore punk rock, world music, punk, some jazz occasionally. It was an amazing spread of talent and genres where, you're right, the audience changed every night.
Yeah,
and I felt comfortable in all of them because my job, that was my job, and that was where my taste lie. I had a lot of diverse tastes. And it was fun being part of, a flipper crowd one night and a P-Funk crowd another night.
Oh, yeah.
And in retrospect, it's become more interesting, you know?
Well, yeah, you look back on it. I mean, Spit had obviously a punk rock emphasis, The Rat, certainly. Most of Don Law's shows, some were maybe a little off in the fringe area, but not as much as what the Channel would do. I don't think he took as many risks as what the Channel did and what Warren did, I guess, primarily in the booking. It brought people to, frankly, an area, on the edge of South Boston that a lot of people didn't really know about or think about or consider. And then it became what it became, and it became this kind of mecca for many of us.
Yeah,
and,
I think it established with the local bands in the early 80s as a bigger stage for them to play, and then it became a scene that the club itself was a draw. And I think that's what allowed them to take more risks,
Yeah, the local part of it, definitely true. I mean, I think you're right. It was the biggest stage a lot of these guys had played.
And it had a car park in downtown. That was the big
Oh, I know. Man, that was a privilege, wasn't it?
Yeah, you could park.
And it was home till 2 o'clock in the morning, so you could...
Yeah, I know. And believe me, that was an attraction. I mean, it's sort of like, okay, anywhere else, where the hell am I going to park? And, how much am I going to pay? Right. And here, just find a space and you're good.
And I think that's what allowed for a lot of the risks. And, of course, the capacity, to the agents was appealing to put some of the bigger acts in and to get those kind of numbers without being in a theater,
Yeah.
Especially in the 80s.
Especially then, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I was just trying to scroll back in my mind about some of the many, many bands I saw.
Did you see Man of War there?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry, Jim.
No, go ahead.
I remember the Jerry Lee Lewis day clearly.
Yeah.
I was there. I'm a manager on duty on one of those, and I'd written notes on that day because I was so blown away. First thing we were doing, Jerry
Probably
Lee
one
Lewis.
Of the notes was keep the IRS agents away from Jerry Lee.
I remember first thing in the morning showing up to open up, and there were guys standing around ready to serve papers.
Yes.
At 9:30 in the morning, and we were avoiding them all day long, and smuggling him in there in his fur coat.
Yeah, very much so. I have a
very strong memory of that.
You know what was fun too. Again, back to the kind of diverse bookings that you had. You brought black bands in there, which was pretty cool in a city that, as we know, could be somewhat racially divided.
I think it very much was. I think if you look at the Lansdowne Street bookings in those days, especially the world beat music, nobody was touching reggae.
Right. And that, right. No, that, it became, yeah.
That gave us a real edge.
There was the Western Front, of course, for you know, the hardcore reggae scene. But the channel brought a lot of reggae to the main
And world music. You know. World music, King Sonny.
King Sonny Ade, a lot of world stuff. Fela Kuti at the Opera House.
Absolutely. Black Uhuru, I remember seeing there. Yeah. They were terrific. Yellow Man was there a lot.
Yellow Man, and then of course we had the names. Jimmy Cliff would play there, and and Toots, Toots and the Maytals, and all of them.
They loved the place. They absolutely loved it.
Yep.
We like to think, Dinky and I like to think, we had a bit of an edge there, because the Jamaicans, a lot of times the reggae guys were misunderstood, let's say, when they came to the Northeast. And had a reputation for being difficult to deal with.
We had no problem.
We had no problem because we just start talking cricket with them. that would break the ice right away.
Cricket and football, soccer.
I had a term for you know what I would try to do if I'm covering a show. I'd call up and say, "Hey guys, what time? You know, what are the set times?" And I had a standard in my head when a reggae band was playing. I was covering. I called it RST, Reggae Standard Time.
There you go.
That meant the set was at least an hour, probably an hour and a half after the start time.
That's right. Yeah. Soon come.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but he had fun. I mean, even Steve Morse was with his little friend there that used to come in there for the reggae. And I forget his name now. I just had his name. Just really, really enjoyed themselves for all the different kinds of sounds, different kinds of music. You did the same, even with the straight punk stuff and what have you. And you know, you see Billy Bragg, people like that.
Gang of Four.
Billy played his first show in America in the channel.
And the New Order thing, I missed them at the Underground for some reason, so that was my first show with the channel, and they had just that one album out, or extended EP, I guess it was, and it was all very tentative and very moody and, you know, fragile because of Ian's death, and everyone's a little, you know, walking on tenterhooks a bit.
Sure.
And you know, they weren't accomplished yet as New Order. They weren't the band that they became.
Right.
They were the band spinning out of Joy Division and doing their best without a real singer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was real special to see. Again, you know, a band that had become, you know, very popular in England, less so in America, meaning Joy Division, and then having to reboot themselves without their singer and trying to figure out what the hell they're going to do. To see them, you know, they almost were a baby band in a weird way.
But it was a big enough room to be able to draw their old fans from, you know, whatever they had. Same thing with Sisters of Mercy was like that, and Big Audio Dynamite when they came
through. Big Audio, that was good.
Yeah, right, sure, same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Remember Graham Chapman coming through?
Yeah. Good one. I'd forgotten about that, but yes, I do. And don't forget all the John Waters stuff, the Egg Lady, and
and then
the fun stuff like Dred Zeppelin with Mojo Nixon.
Exactly. I think I recall Mojo getting naked in the dressing room backstage when I was there. Oh, Mojo, there are some things we don't want to see. Come on.
But you see, it was that kind of scene, and you could enjoy yourself. You'd see stars coming in there and whatever at night that wanted to see other bands.
See other shows,
You know?
You know, I think when you talk about or write about, you know, as I did in the books here, you know, you're going back to an era that doesn't exist anymore. And I mean that in terms of both as a fan and as a critic. And the access I had at the channel was usually pretty tremendous. I mean, pretty much anywhere, and being able to talk to many of these bands and get really great stories from them, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. You know,
No. You have to pay for it now.
The rigidity of the backstage pass thing, the layers of passes, the publicists to get through, the security to get through. And it was, you know, it wasn't loose in the channel. It wasn't like anybody could do it. But, I mean, if you had a reason to be there, and I did, it made it easier to do my work and have my fun.
I think at the time we all were in a situation that we appreciated what everybody was bringing to the promotion of and sustaining and trying to keep that scene in Boston going. You know, I think I think everybody understood their part. You know.
Yeah, and
we all loved the music, so we were all trying to push it forward.
Right.
And it's different now because you have to pay just to go into a place and do this, that, and the other. And like you guys at the Swans and stuff like that, even though I'm sure you got yourselves in, it's just one of these time periods is all gone.
It's like the newspaper business, Jim. Huh? The accountants took over.
Oh, my.
I'm sorry, I missed the last
piece. The accountants took over all our businesses.
Oh, yeah, I know.
The creative went away.
Live Nation became, Don Law into Live Nation. It became what it became. And then,
it's huge. It's huge. The little clubs that's still around, that's still available, the ones in Cambridge there that's still around.
That's right.
Sure.
You know, that. They're trying still to do the 80s stuff, but it's a tough number because the clientele is different. Only one that would be in there would be you, the people that love that stuff, and what have you, and that would love to be able to support it by just going there, having a drink and seeing, wow, well, all my friends are still around and some of them are still at it.
It's interesting to see what might be the next alternative, Jim, and I don't know what your take is on it, but I look at things like the Moth Hour, which is still something else, something alternative and creative, and without that, I think a lot of what we do is dying.
Yeah.
Well, the upside of looking back on that, as I've said this before, is those were in many ways kind of glory days, whether we knew it or not at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
And oftentimes I didn't, because I just thought this is great, it's going to keep going. I wasn't looking at a projection about where things might end up.
Well, the channel had a 10-year run. That's still pretty good.
That's pretty good in and of itself.
I
felt, looking back on it, I feel privileged to have been there, having that kind of access and having those kind of bands come through on a regular basis. And, being frankly the right age, in my 20s to into my 30s, and that's prime time for the music itself and the writing of it and all the rest of it. So, you formed different bonds with different audiences every night. And I'll tell you, this is one of the, I think, fun stories about the channel. And I did include it in my chapter on George Clinton, but I'll tell it here, too. I think it's a good story. When Clinton and P-Funk played the channel, it was a few years after a situation on the North Shore where there was a booking that ended up in something of a melee or riot after the show. There was some racial violence and robberies and things that went on after it. There was obviously, that tension in the air because of, whatever, because of P-Funk, because of an audience that was both black and white. The channel audience, I thought, was really pretty much split down the middle, about 50-50, and that was great to see walking in. And one thing I remember, I was at the back bar, pretty crowded, and I was in the back line of the back bar, and people were pushing by to go to the men's room. I was there, and I got bumped, and I got pushed into the guy in front of me who happened to be black. And given the situation that was sort of ever-present, I bumped him, and he turned around, and both of us immediately, in sync, started to apologize. It was funny because he's like, neither one of us wanted anything. We both knew it was just an accident. No one is dissing anybody here. But the humor of it was, he was simultaneous.
Yeah.
As soon as he turned around, I'm in full apologetic mode, and he's in full apologetic mode, and then we just both had this great laugh.
Yeah, no, that's great.
That's great. That's
we didn't have to discuss the situation. We knew what the situation was.
Yeah, and that's a good observation, too.
Great one.
I always felt totally safe in the channel on the reggae nights and every other night, and I think that was a kind of a comfort zone there for, especially a lot of the white guys who were getting into world music and alternative stuff, to be to be able to be able to integrate in there and just enjoy the music, you know.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, and flip it around to the hardcore shows, punk shows, you know, same sort of thing. I mean, mostly those were the days where, you know, the mosh pit policed itself. Not all the time. I mean, there were times that it didn't work, and your security had to come in, and they did their job.
Yeah.
But by and large, you know, it was a crowd that knew, you know, kind of what the boundaries were, even if they wanted to smash those boundaries as much as they could without causing great harm.
I think there was always respect for the fact that we were bringing those acts in, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, very much so. All the all-ages shows. Yeah. And, right. I mean, you were the place to go for kids that were young and, you know, wanted to get that energy out and be part of the hardcore movement. So,
Heavy Metal important. Christmas. I mean, come on. Heavy Metal Christmas.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And Gwar, I think, on Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, Gwar, of course, on Halloween. And don't forget the Cramps on Halloween.
Oh, yeah, that was Halloween.
New Year's Eve.
I think we did New Year's with the Cramps.
Yes, indeed.
You just mentioned Gwar. The one thing that's interesting about Gwar, and I have to say that most of those who were in performance art, There was something that was bad, such as like Gwar squirting their, you know, blood stuff all over everybody.
But the
roadies covered all my monitors up. Not only did they cover the monitors up, when the gig was done, they were even taking gaffer's tape off the damn drum riser. They cleaned everything.
I had such
respect for the place so they could play back again. But we told them...
I mean, they would kind of have to do that if they wanted a return engagement, right?
That's exactly true. I mean, it's not like Butthole Surface when I kicked out the back door when he set fire to that damn cymbal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, once that happened, I says, that's it. We don't need that kind of crap in here. See you later, bye.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Give me music, give me fun, give me this, that, and the other, but no fire business.
I remember watching Dinky Storm on stage one night, Jim, after Paul Westerberg. Because he dumped a half a beer down the monitor speaker in front of him.
Oh, no.
And Dinky tore out there in the middle of the show and grabbed him.
And no messing with that lot. I ain't going to piddle with that lot. But any of them, you know, they've got to respect it. I mean, and most of the bands that came through that didn't have a sound system or didn't have this, that, and other big bands really enjoyed working in the channel because of the sound, because of the
light,
because of the people. And that you wrote a lot about a lot of those nights because there was some good stuff every time you turn around, and with it being open till 2 o'clock in the morning, you had time to be able to put stuff together because you'd already seen a bunch of stuff at either the Rat or the Old Paradise or at Garden or wherever early on in the night, you know, and stuff.
Yeah,
like
right.
That.
Did you used to make the rounds a lot at night? Just hit 3 or 4 places, Jim.
Say it again, sorry.
Did you used to make the rounds in Boston like most nights when you were covering the show?
Not often. No, to be honest with you, I didn't. I tended to be in one place, mostly because, you know, I was writing.
Yeah.
So I had an assignment, and when the gig was done, I wanted to get my thoughts down on, you know, paper, computer, whatever it was. So, no, I didn't do as much club hopping night to night. I mean, you know, within the same night, over the course of a week, but not really.
I know you were always on the scene.
Always.
One thing we should mention in terms of security and fun and danger would be the Butthole Surfers, right?
Yeah.
You know, the upturned cymbal with the lighter fluid.
That's what Dinky was saying,
I threw him out the back door when he did that. I had enough of that stuff. I mean, the girl peeing in the cup and stuff on stage. I mean, performance. And then prior to that was the damn video from
the video of the pre trans.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I understand the performance art, but the performance art's got to be some kind of quality, not dissing everybody, you know, and everybody in every culture. And
I didn't realize all that stuff was such a big part of their act until I was reading last month's Mojo, Jim.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Apparently, the flaming cymbal was de rigueur every night, and it was all part of the show.
Yeah, I read that story too. Well, I figured it wasn't unique to the channel, to be honest with you. But I mean, I didn't know, and it was part of the act. But you know, the thing was probably in other places, maybe there was a higher ceiling or something. I mean, the flames were licking the ceiling of the channel.
Well, and you had were you there for Spinal Tap?
Oh yeah, you bet.
So you had the water business and the false ceiling falling down on top of them.
Yes.
See that?
Yep.
Yeah, so that was that one. When I came in a few weeks later in 86 there, I ripped down that whole roof thing, yep, all false that ceiling, false roof yeah. and what have you. And because, you know, I'm saying to myself, this is dangerous stuff where these guys are slam dancing and cage diving and this, that and the other. And security was trying to run around and stop all that stuff. I said, and then when they came with the damn lighter fluid and stuff like that, we didn't want any more of that, you know, not at all. So let's take it down.
It was low enough that I remember the kids climbing in the rafters on the punk shows.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, there's a fine line, of course, between, you know, almost danger and real danger.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, it can be kind of thrilling to see the almost danger part of it. Yeah, if it crossed over into an actual fire, that's another story. That's right. Coconut Grove, right. Maybe, you know.
Yeah, right.
But,
right.
But you know, the illusion of it or the feeling that, hey, something might go really terribly wrong here, you know, there's a thrill in that. I mean, it's almost like people watching NASCAR races, right?
You know? Oh, yeah. Oh, you never know, yeah.
Isn't that rock and roll, Jim?
Yeah, it is. Hey, look, guys, I kind of got to run. So
it's okay.
We've
taken plenty of your time and really appreciate you.
We did a good half hour there and some good talks and good memories that we all have. Fun to bring them up.
Well, thanks for sharing.
Well, thank you for sharing that on Two Pints in a Corner. There's the Jim
Sullivan. Yes, indeed. Please send me a link to when it goes up somewhere. Will you do that?
We'll do, Jim, and I'll pick up your book. I know Tim said he was enjoying it.
Absolutely. Please do. Thanks, man.
Thanks, man.
Take care, Jakey. Take care, Tony.
Bye-bye.